Hey everyone, it's Friday, October 30th, 2020. Welcome to episode 35 of the Ginger and the Beard podcast. I'm AJ, aka the Ginger.
And I'm Reese, aka the Beard.
On this week's show, we'll be drinking and reviewing craft beers from High Wire Brewing and Lancaster Brewing Company, talking about PlayStation's view on VR's place in gaming, and a new tactic for politicians to connect with voters.
We'll also be giving a tribute to Anderson Silva, talking about a new haptics development suite. And since it's Halloween weekend, we'll be reminiscing on our favorite games of the horror genre.
But before we get started, I want to remind you to subscribe on YouTube, follow us on Spotify, and if you really want to help us grow, share our show with a friend. We truly appreciate your support.
Yes, and make sure to check out the YouTube chapters or the timestamps in the description if you'd like to skip around to your favorite topics. All right, man, we got a lot to cover, so let's get into this. How was your week, sir?
It was good, man. I can't believe the week is already over. It flew by. It flew by. Nothing major happened. I think one sort of negative to my week was I had to go to the dermatologist this week, which is a good thing. I recommend you go to the dermatologist, people. But they every time I go in there, dude, they slice me up. I leave with less of my body than I come in there with.
What? What do you mean?
Yeah, so I'm a moly person just by nature. And so since I'm a ginger, they like to be very careful with my skin.
Yeah.
And they examine all the things and they're like, yeah, we should check that one out. We should send that one off and get it checked. I'm like, you know what? It's going to cost me some money, but also my health is more important than the money. So send it off. Check it out. Make sure I'm good. You know? So anyways, this is a reminder to you folks out there. Go get your checkups. It's important.
Yeah. Speaking of which, I'm overdue. Yeah. It's been a while.
Yeah, man. It's important stuff.
Gotta get out there.
Beyond that, pretty good week, man. Today, I actually had a half day off. My wife did too. Shana did too. So we went and had some sushi for lunch, went to Farmhouse, picked up some new beer. I'm not drinking that tonight, but I'm going to be reviewing that at a later time. And it was overall just an awesome afternoon, man. I'm excited to be here and chat with you.
Sweet. That's awesome.
How about you, man? How was your week?
Well, I also took a half day today, so that was nice. But it was not really, it wasn't like a real half day. I didn't get off until like 1:30, so it doesn't really count, but yeah. But, and then I just played video games, watched YouTube. Tomorrow we're going to be going out and doing a lot of things, but yeah, the rest of the week, like you said, man, it just flew by. I mean, yeah. You know, we had the highlight of my week, you know, the interview with, the Beers and Beers, Beards podcast on Tuesday. That was really nice, but you know,
so awesome.
Besides that, it was just work, man. That was it.
Yeah, it's awesome. I definitely recommend you guys listening out there, go check out that episode 34. We had a great conversation with those guys. Really cool to get to know them and talk UFC and beer. Hopefully we'll have them on again in the future.
Speaking of beer, you want to jump into our beer segment?
Yeah, man, I'm ready for it.
All right, man. Let's get into it. What you drinking?
All right, man. So this week we didn't put a poll up. I'm going to be honest with you guys. I forgot again. Oh my gosh. Blame me. Shoot me. Don't do that. Don't shoot me. I'm a nice guy. But yeah, sorry about that, guys. I forgot to put the polls up, but I had some delicious beers in the fridge. So this is another one I actually talked about on Tuesday on our episode. One of the beers that I picked up in Asheville. This is another one from High Wire Brewing in downtown Asheville. It's called Fest Beer. Really cool label design here. Really cool can artwork. It's like very minimalistic. If you guys are just listening to the audio version, it's like this really pretty solid white with these cool blue bands and this diagonal pattern at the bottom. There's like this creamy sort of metallic gold texture, you know, this like wave at the bottom. It's just really cool. Really cool and clean. Good job, guys. But this is a lager, kind of stepping away from the IPAs that I usually bring to the show. It's a lager brewed with, hopefully I'm pronouncing this right, Ursprung, U-R-S-P-R-U-N-G, Ursprung Fest Malt from Epiphany Craft Malt. So Epiphany Craft Malt, actually also in North Carolina. It's a local craft malt, distributor. I'm not really sure what they call themselves. But the description that they give of the beer on the website is that it brings a balanced malt character reminiscent of fresh baked bread. So that sounds interesting.
Yum.
I'm going to go ahead and crack this bad boy open. Get some ASMR here.
I feel better already. Oh, yeah. I feel better already.
Can I give this a pour, guys?
Yeah, so that malt distributor sounds good. I would like to talk to them, and I think we're going to try and get something together with that. My counterpart here, the Ginger, is certainly more of a hops guy, but I am definitely the malt one, and I want to learn more. Hey, that looks good.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of head there, but I think it was a malfunction with the can. The little metal tab thing didn't push all the way in, so it made sort of a weird pour. So I got a little bit left here. I'm going to try to let that settle for a second. But off the bat, very malty. I guess I have a hard time. I'm still learning how to describe these sort of beers, but like almost a yeasty sort of smell to it. So I definitely get that baked bread, that bready sort of smell. Let me see if I can get a little more out of this pour.
Yeah, like it's like a sweet bread kind of smell to it, right?
Yeah, it definitely is. It really is. And so speaking of malts and the craft malt thing, I realized as I was, you know, trying to take some notes on this beer before while prepping for the show that I didn't know a lot about what role malt plays in brewing. So real quick lesson on malt here, guys, before I get into the review of this beer. It turns out that malting is actually a process of germinating the grains which are in the brew. And that germination happens when grains actually puff up, and that's where they become full of starch. And that starch is what creates the sugars that the yeast feed off of. Germination obviously is a natural process that happens, but for this sort of thing, for malting, the grains are actually steeped indoors for a certain period of time, steeped in water, until they begin to, you know, puff up and sprout. And at that point, the process is stopped abruptly and they begin the roasting process. And depending on the temperature of the roast, the length, the duration of the roast, and, you know, how they, you know, do the roasting itself, all of that impacts the flavor profiles of the malt, the color of the beer. Malt actually affects color, sweetness, alcohol content, and carbonation of the beer. So the more malts, the higher the alcohol content because there's more sugar for the yeast to feed on, which in turn creates more carbonation. You know, so really all of this kind of plays into each other. And obviously the flavor profile, depending on the type of grain and again, how they actually go about malting and roasting, all of that impacts the flavor, whether it's more smoky or caramely or sweet, you know, so all of that's impacted by the malt. So super interesting. That's what we're saying. I'd love to get, especially the folks from Epiphany Craft Malt, which is where the malt in this beer comes from. It turns out that this particular Fest malt actually is grown in Germany and then shipped from Germany to Epiphany. And that's where they do the malting themselves in Durham, North Carolina. And then it ends up in this delicious beer. So let's go ahead and give this a try. Okay, so definitely malty, definitely you know, that bready sort of taste to it. Very well balanced. Smooth. I would definitely describe this as a sort of an easy drinker. I could definitely see getting through a couple of these. It's only 5.8%. It's pretty low ABV. But I really love the flavor profile of this. It's not bitter at all in the least. Take another sip. It's got a really nice golden color to it.
Yeah, it does. Not a lot of haziness.
No, not much haziness. Really, now that the pour is kind of settled down, it's not a thick head there. Really good mouthfeel too. Just, you know, just kind of coats the inside of your mouth there a little bit, and that breadiness kind of sticks around with each sip. But yeah, nice. Overall, this is really, really good and really cool to know that you're drinking a malt. You know, especially if I were from North Carolina, it'd be cool to know that the malt and everything was produced in the same state and all that good stuff. So definitely recommend, you know, hopefully Reese, you can try one of these out one day, make your way to Asheville. Maybe we'll take a bro trip to Asheville one day and get some beers. But Highwire, really cool brewery too. Another like sort of warehouse garage feel brewery. very small, you know, kind of an, I guess, quote unquote, intimate setting. But yeah, a lot of delicious beers coming out of there. I've got a few more in the fridge that I'm excited to try, but Fest Beer, definitely recommend checking that one out.
Sounds amazing. And I'll, you know, sign me up, dude, sign me up, man. I would love to go down there. I think we'd have a great time, try out a lot of beer, you know, that'd be, yeah, get cool. A babysitter. We're in, but,
yeah, man, what about you? What do you got to drink tonight?
Well, I have a baked pumpkin ale. I'm not sure how much malt it has in it. And speaking of malt, you know, that, you know, the lesson you just gave us was awesome. I didn't really, you know about all that. So that was very helpful to me. And I really want to learn some more about it soon. But,
go ahead. Sorry, not to cut you off, but I think that's just scratching the surface too. Like the more I read, it was like all these crazy like reasons for the different types of like chemicals and different types of like, I don't know, I can't even describe it. All these fancy words they were using as to what impacts the flavor of the malt.
Yeah.
Yeah. It would be awesome to learn more about that.
I want to learn all about it because next time I brew a beer, I want to pick my own malts. Maybe not make my own, but you know, pick my own. Add my own flavor profile. Anyway, we got a Lancaster Brewing Company baked pumpkin ale. If you're listening, what we got here is a bottle with an orange label. It's got a pumpkin pie sitting with a dollop of Miracle Whip sitting on top. It's steaming. It's got a cool little look to it. You know, nothing too crazy, but makes me a little thirsty. That's for sure. You know, their site basically describes it as this: have your pie and drink it too. Bold flavor with a deep amber color. Our big baked pumpkin ale is sure to remind you of grandma's homemade pumpkin pie. Hey. All right, let's crack this sucker open. It's 7.5 ABV.
Nice.
Described as having a very bold and strong spice to it with some pumpkin underneath. So just on this initial pour, I didn't get a very strong head, but the head that I did get is fairly uniform. I'd say this is probably moderately uniform head on top, and that head is gone already. And we're clear, man. We got clear copper. We got
that color.
Yeah, this is a clear, very strong copper look to it. A little bit surprising for an ale, I think, but I guess it's, you know, pumpkin spice. They're trying to stick with this, you know, orange kind of deal. So it makes sense that they would make it this color. Let's go ahead and give it let's see. Definitely. What was that?
I said give it a little sniffy.
Yeah, I got to give it a little sniff here. Yeah, you know, pumpkin spice, you know, every time you get a pumpkin beer, it's never really like the pumpkin, right? It's always those spices that you smell.
Oh, yeah.
It's mostly just pumpkin spice and caramel smell to it. Let's sip
cinnamon, some clove.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, wow. Whoa, hold on. Okay. Just gave it a couple sips. I didn't get the IBU on it, but it's feeling like it's probably between a 15 and a 20. A little bit more bitter than I expected, actually. A lot bitter on the end, but the initial sip is very sweet. A lot of sweetness to it. Sweet with the pumpkin spice, and just, you know, as it's going on, as it's continuing and I'm evaluating it, I'm getting the pumpkin, right? The pumpkin... What would you call the pumpkin? Like the inside of the pumpkin? I guess just pumpkin.
Guts?
Pumpkin flesh? Pumpkin flesh. We'll go with that. I'm getting the mushy pumpkin stuff. as it goes on. So yeah, it's pretty light. I think I think for an ale this is probably what you would expect as far as like hoppiness goes, and but it's nice and smooth. I feel like it's not too heavy on the pumpkin ale. I feel like this is something that you would really enjoy because of like the light hoppiness to it.
Yeah.
So it's not overbearing either way. Cause usually if you're drinking like an IPA, sometimes they're like very hoppy and bitter. Or if you're drinking a pumpkin ale, sometimes they're like way too much, right?
Oh, yeah.
Where it's like, okay, well, that's my only pumpkin beer for the season. I'm clocked out. Yeah, this is something where it's like, yeah, you know, this is right where I want a pumpkin ale, for sure. So, bravo to Lancaster. I think they did a pretty good job. I wouldn't, you know, say it's the best pumpkin ale I've ever had. You know, but it's definitely good. Definitely good.
Solid.
Worth a shot.
Yeah, I 100% agree with you. That's exactly what I think, too, when it comes to pumpkin ales or any of these, like, I don't know, sort of like seasonally spiced brews. If you could, there's definitely a fine line. I mean, I guess everything's kind of subjective, right, too. It depends on what your preference is. But for me, I agree with you. Like, I definitely don't like the overly flavored pumpkin beers that are just too much. I like a nice, subtle, spicy hint of pumpkin.
Yeah, I think that's what I would prefer. I think, you know, my perfect pumpkin beer would be, like you said, very slight pumpkin spice, pumpkin taste to it. And then it would probably be a lager. It would probably have more maltiness to it and just a hint of hoppiness. I think that would probably be, you know, where I would land on a good pumpkin beer in general.
Yeah, definitely. And I think David and Gary mentioned when we interviewed them on Tuesday that David said he went and I think, did he say he had every seasonal beer from Ohio or something like that? I think he said some insane amount of seasonal beers. So,
but it was, I think it was all like Oktoberfest and, you know, pumpkin ales and everything. And he did that like two or three weekends ago. He went on a tour, I think a tour of, I was going to say a binge, but I didn't want to say that. He went on a tour, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Makes more sense.
I have to check that out.
Yeah.
That's awesome, man. Well, delicious beers. Cheers to you, sir. I think we got some UFC shenanigans to talk about.
Yeah, man. Let's jump in the shenanigans. All right. Well, hit me with what you got, man. What's going on in the world of UFC today?
All right. Well, obviously, we've got a big fight coming up tomorrow night. Well, big, I guess you could put in quotations. Big in the sense that it's Anderson Silva's last fight. And we're actually going to get to that in a second. But Uriah Hall versus Anderson Silva, headline in the card tomorrow night. But other than that, not a lot going on in the UFC right now in terms of, like, you know, this I feel like this year especially has been filled with drama and excitement every single week for one reason or another. But you know, after sort of, you know, Khabib's win last week, the industry's been kind of quiet overall, besides people complaining that he shouldn't be called the GOAT and he shouldn't be the number one pound for pound right now. But I feel like that's kind of been kind of beating a dead horse. But looking a little bit further out into the future, the UFC 255 card, which is headlined by Davison Figueiredo and I don't remember who he's fighting, honestly, but regardless, Mike Perry was slated to fight Robbie Lawler on November 21st. And, you know, I haven't done a lot of looking into this, but I'm curious, did Mike Perry fulfill his, expectation of getting professional help for his anger/alcohol substance abuse, issues, you know, after that incident he had where he put hands on some innocent people. But regardless, Robbie had to pull out of the fight because of an injury. And so that left Mike Perry without an opponent. And so Mike Perry's calling out Khamzat Chimaev, which is very interesting.
Yeah.
But Khamzat actually already got a fight booked with Leon Edwards on December 19th. So this is really interesting. I found this really interesting this week. You know, we've been hearing a lot from Leon Edwards. He's the number 3 ranked middleweight right now. And he's not getting a lot of love. So I am right, right? It is middleweight. I think Jorge guys.
Yeah, it is middleweight. You're right. I had to think about it too for a second.
Oh, sorry. No, we're wrong. It's welterweight. Yeah, sorry. Kamara's got that belt.
I know the weight's better.
Let's start going with numbers.
Yeah.
Words are hard. So anyways, Leon's been, you know, making a lot of noise lately because he hasn't had a fight since 2019. And it turns out that earlier this week, he was actually removed from the rankings for the welterweight division completely. And the rumor was that it was because he hadn't been accepting fights that they were offering him. And they listed out, I think an article had a bunch of fights listed out that he was offered and didn't accept. But his story is actually the complete opposite, saying that none of these other fighters have been accepting his offers to take fights. So not really sure who to believe there, but shortly after all that happened, he was added back to the welterweight rankings, still at number three. And now he's got a fight coming up on December 19th with Khamzat. So again, this will be Leon's first fight since 2019. He's on an 8-fight win streak, which I thought was pretty insane. I'm not sure what the record is for welterweight win streaks, but that's pretty high. I mean, for fighters in general, you know, most of those were decisions. He doesn't have a whole lot of highlight KOs and things like that. But then you've got Khamzat, who's 9-0 and on a 3-fight win streak in the UFC and coming off that dominant win over Gerald Meerschaert. So I'm curious your thoughts on this matchup.
Yeah, this is very interesting because I honestly thought Leon Edwards was a bit underrated. I feel like he's a very good fighter and deserves to be in the top 10, but wasn't really given very many opportunities, or he didn't take opportunities. I don't know about all that drama, but I think this is a very scary fight for Khamzat. Personally, I'm a little bit afraid for him because he's got all this hype behind him. And, you know, he hasn't really had any really significant challenges, I would say. So this is going to be his test. But I feel like I kind of want to maybe would rather have him fight somebody else. Maybe not Leon Edwards at this point. Somebody maybe between somebody in the top 15, I would say he could handle. But, you know, not top 10 at this point. This could be his, you know, he could get derailed here, his hype train.
Yeah, I think he might be biting off a little bit more than he can chew here, but I guess that all depends on who you ask. I mean, there's so many dominant players in the welterweight division right now. Like, even at number 14, you've got Anthony Pettis. You know, up from that, you've got Nate Diaz, Rafael dos Anjos, Jeff Neal, like Vicente Luque. It's just monsters in that division. You know, and Leon has worked his way through most of those guys. Like his last fight in 2019, he won a 5-round decision against Rafael dos Anjos. Before that, Gunnar Nelson. Before that, Donald Cerrone. In 2017, he beat Vicente Luque. So, you know, you think about what is Khamzat's main play here. I mean, obviously he's got power, he's got strength, but you look at the guys that Leon Edwards has gone through. Vicente Luque, I'm looking at general, you know, talk about power, right?
Highlight on that one, man. If he beat Vicente Luque, I didn't know that. And that makes me worry even more because I was actually thinking that before you even said Vicente Luque, I was like, Khamzat versus Vicente. I would like to see that, but that scares me. But I don't think that's as scary as Leon Edwards. So
right.
I guess, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Leon's last loss was to Kamaru in December of 2015.
Wow.
So I'm not sure how he hasn't gotten a title shot yet. Honestly, I think that's what his whole gripe has been. He's like, what, you know, why is Dana not giving me any love? You know, we've talked about this at length. It's all about the hype. It's all about the stars and stuff like that. And maybe Leon's just, it seems like today, if you're not talking trash and you're not showing out, you know, on social media, then you're not getting the attention. Unfortunately.
Are they setting Khamzat up for failure?
I don't know. To be honest with you, I feel like Dana really likes Khamzat. So I feel like maybe he sees potential in him that he's just like, you know what? Let's just skip all the nonsense. Let's put him up against a top five fighter and see how he does. And then maybe we'll prove one way or the other. Is he the real deal? I think he stands a chance for sure. I just think his body type, his power, could pose a big challenge for Leon, because I think Leon's a relatively small guy, right? Compared to Khamzat. I have to check that out. But
well, yeah, I mean, Khamzat can fight up a weight class. I think they're fairly similar in structure.
Leon's 6 foot. I feel like Khamzat's larger than that.
Well, you know, regardless, I think that really this is just going to be his biggest challenge. You know, so I'm very excited to see how this goes. Either we're going to see Khamzat get derailed, or if he beats Leon, maybe that's what the matchmakers are trying to do. They're trying to see if this is going to be the next superstar, you know?
Exactly. Yeah.
I don't think he will be, though, because he's not much of a talker.
I mean, he's calling people out though. He's not doing a lot of trash talking per se, but he's definitely calling people out. You know, like as soon as he finishes one guy, he's on to the next. But now that I think about it, didn't they already have somebody booked for him with the whole, that was the whole Gerald Meerschaert thing, right? Like he was all disrespected because they already had somebody booked for him.
Yeah, Damian Maia. He was booked. I don't know what happened to that.
Yeah, what happened to that fight?
I don't think it was officially booked. I think it was just lined up, and then it just didn't come through.
So. Damian Maia out. UFC negotiating with Wonder Boy. This was September 28th.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I remember the Wonder Boy thing. They were trying to find somebody for him, and they couldn't get it. They couldn't pull it together.
Yeah. Man, Wonder Boy hasn't fought in a long time either. It'd be great to see him come back. But
yeah. Well, in the interest of time, I want to, you know, speaking of the event this Saturday, you know, Anderson Silva has mentioned, I think last week, that this is probably going to be his, well, he said this is his last fight, essentially. So I just wanted to, you know, kind of take this time real quick to just, you know, pay tribute to Anderson Silva, what he's done for the sport. You know, so, you know, just jumping right into it. He's had 45 matches in his professional career, 34, 10, and 1, 22 knockouts. I mean, that's pretty intense, man. That's 2/3 of your wins are by knockout. 4 submissions and 8 by decision. You know, so he finished 26 out of 34 of his wins. That's pretty crazy. He holds the record for the longest title reign in UFC history at 2,457 days. It started in 2006 and went until 2013.
Insane. You know,
so 7 years, essentially. He reigned for 7 years. It included a UFC record 16 consecutive victories. So not only the longest title reign, but the most consecutive victories. I think that's as a title holder, not as like, not just like professional UFC. I think it's as a title holder. So, you know, just to give you a comparison, GSP's number 2 on the list, and he's got 2,064 days with 9 consecutive title defenses. So 16 consecutive title victories. That's what I was supposed to say there. So, I mean,
16 title defenses.
16 title defenses is what I'm trying to say. So, you know, comparing to GSP, I mean, he's got more than a year on GSP, who's second in line. I mean, he's going to hold that record 7 years for a long time. I mean, he's one of the best that's ever done it, you know. He's not in the GOAT talk at this very moment, but he was the GOAT during his reign. He was the GOAT, and
he was the GOAT before the GOAT was a thing.
Yeah, exactly. He started it. He did so. You know, he's an expert in Muay Thai, Wing Chun, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, Taekwondo, and Capoeira, a couple of interesting facts. Before he began his career as a professional fighter, he worked at McDonald's and as a filing clerk. Really cool news as well is he became a naturalized U.S. citizen in July of 2019. And, you know, there's probably some negative things that we could talk about, but I don't want to go there. Let's just focus on the positive. You know, Uriah Hall is a tough match. And, you know, I'd be happy to see him win his last fight. I think that would be great. Yeah, I think that'd be really awesome. But, yeah, I mean, I just remember, you know, back during that time frame, it was all about Anderson Silva. He was just mopping the floor with people.
Right.
You know, and it was the Anderson show, basically.
Yeah, definitely, dude. I mean, anybody who's followed the sport for any considerable amount of time knows the name Anderson Silva. People who, I mean, he was sort of the Conor McGregor of that time period. It's like, even if you didn't watch UFC, you've still heard that name. You're still familiar with him. And I agree with your sentiment not to go with the, you know, some of the negative aspects of it, but he just seems like an all around great guy. Like he's a very good, you know, we talked about with Gary and David, different personas that we don't like to be included in the sport. This is the type of persona that you do want to be associated with the sport. You know, the respect that he has for other fighters in victory and in defeat is, you know, unrivaled amongst many. And I think that sets an example for many people, many other fighters coming after him. You know, so I definitely think he leaves a very good legacy with the UFC if he does retire. There are some, you know, some articles are out saying that maybe he's not going to retire. Maybe he's not done. You know, it's just hard to believe at 45 and as long as he's gone without winning at this point, you know, that he would continue if he were to lose again tomorrow. It's hard to imagine that he would not continue on, but I'd love to see him. I was just trying to find an article. I thought I saw an article earlier today or yesterday that he might be looking at a different promotion, you know, maybe fighting outside of the UFC or maybe doing something else in the sport as opposed to fighting. So it'd be cool to see him still stick around in some capacity, whether that's, I obviously don't see him being like a commentator just based on, you know, the language barrier. I don't know. It'd be cool to see him around still.
Yeah. You know, who knows, you know, I'm sure he's going to have some, influence in the fight world, right? Maybe coaching, have his own gym. Who knows? He's got tons of options, but you know, really, I think it's just, you know, he just did such a good job, as a fighter. And sorry if you guys heard that. That was my dog just getting all excited and running in here to see me. Anyway,
did you say ball? You said ball? Ball?
Ball? Ball?
Nope, no ball. But yeah, so you know, that's really all we had for the UFC. Super excited for the fight. I'm sure people will be listening to this after the fight, so they'll know how it went. But you know, before or after the fight doesn't matter. You know, we appreciate Anderson Silva and what he's done for the sport.
Yes, absolutely. All right, man. I think it's time we move on and talk about some technology.
I'm pretty sure you're right, man. So let's hop into the talking tech segment. All right. Well, I think you're going to go ahead and start us off. You got some news about PlayStation for us?
Yeah, man. I saw a very interesting article. The article I read was from The Verge, but it was in response to another article, an interview from The Washington Post with PlayStation's CEO, Jim Ryan. So I thought you'd find this particularly interesting. Jim Ryan, PlayStation CEO, said in an interview with The Post that he doesn't think VR will be a meaningful part of gaming for years to come.
Boo.
Boo.
Boo this man.
You suck. You suck. Get him out of there.
Yeah.
No, I'm just kidding. The quote itself actually says, I think we're more than a few. The article said minutes. I'm not sure if that was like a typo. You're typing in a frenzy. You type minutes instead of years. We need to fact check and look at the actual interview if it's a video. But it says, I think we're more than a few minutes from the future of VR. PlayStation believes in VR. Sony believes in VR. And we definitely believe at some point in the future, VR will represent a meaningful component of interactive entertainment. Will it be this year? No. Will it be next year? No. But will it come at some stage? We believe that. So that's an interesting statement. You know, PlayStation VR has been out for a few years now. I don't know how its, you know, adoption compares to something like Oculus Quest, Oculus Quest 2, Oculus Rift, all those other, you know, Vive and those things. I'm not sure what the adoption looks like there. My gut tells me that this seems to be, I mean, you know more than I do. I feel like PlayStation VR is more of an accessible piece of hardware than something like a Rift or, well, I won't say Quest because I don't think that's true. A Rift or an HTC Vive, something that that requires a desktop PC, because I feel like there's probably more consoles in households than desktop PCs. I could be wrong about that. That's just an assumption I'm making. And it's sort of like a plug and play add-on to your console. And it's also supporting the new PlayStation 5 will still support PlayStation VR. So it's kind of an odd statement coming from him at this time. But I'm curious, like, where do you think VR fits into gaming in the future? Now?
Well, so right now, I do think that the Quest 2 offers a very easy entry into the VR realm, right? Into the world of VR. Shout out VRrealm.com, by the way. And I think that, you know, you were right there with it. PlayStation VR is kind of your next step in the line, because, you know, Quest you don't need to have a machine. You don't have to have $1,000 plus machine to run it. With a PC, I'm sorry, with a PSVR, PlayStation VR. Well, if you're a PlayStation user, you probably already got the PlayStation. And what's $200 to go ahead and just grab the VR? So that is an easy way into it. Yeah. And I've used PSVR before, and you know, the quality was fantastic. And I do know that, you know, PSVR isn't really trying to go down this route. But back to your question, I think that it's a niche kind of thing right now. I don't think it's quite mainstream, but I think it's very, we're approaching the tipping point where, you know, a couple little tweaks here and there, certainly more improvements, more realism, more comfort, because that's really what it is, more comfort, some more functionality like pass through so that you can see your surroundings at the click of a button, I think would make more sense. That's one of my concerns is, while you're immersed in VR, what's going on around you? You have no idea. You need to be able to, at the click of a button, see what's around you. But on top of that, haptics, you know, and being really able to feel like you're in the game. That's when it's going to be, you know, that's, I mean, at that point, it had already taken over, I would say. So, I don't know, maybe 5 years, right?
Yeah, I just wonder, like, what's the barrier right now? Like, why is it not? I mean, I remember hearing about VR. I mean, when was the first Oculus, like, I know they called it, like, DK1 back in the day, Developer Kit 1, back in, like, 2012 or something. Like, it's been a while now. We're going on a decade. We've been hearing about it. Obviously, technology takes a while to advance, and we're at the place now where we talk about each week the military adopting things, school systems adopting things, hospitals, training, you know, all this stuff. The more that happens, the faster the technology can grow. But in terms of gaming, which is like the easiest application that you can imagine for VR at this moment, I'm curious why it hasn't taken off more so than it has. Like, I think for me, I don't own a VR headset. My barrier, number one, is cost. And time. I don't have a ton of time to put into it, so it's not really worth my investment. But I think some of the things you just said about haptics, immersion, your surroundings, things like that are still definitely some of the barriers to entry. And really, I think it's awareness. You know, there's not a lot of advertising. Oculus Quest 2, Facebook just started putting out some ads for that. Terrible ads, might I add. They don't show you anything about the device. It just shows you people clicking keyboards and mice and, like, basically, what's the word I'm looking for? Basically, dang, why can't I think of words? Basically making you think, like, the controllers and keyboards and mice you use are just completely outdated technology, and now you can use these VR headsets and step into the future. That's, like, what the gist of the ad is. But it doesn't show you, it doesn't show you anything about the experience of using VR.
Well, it's because the experience isn't that good yet, right?
Yeah,
they're trying to. They just want you to buy the, because they don't own the experience per se. They just own the device through which you gain, through which you get the experience. So they can't vouch for the games, you know, but they can, you know, so they're just showing off their hardware pretty much. But I think that, you know, what they're going to show you on their hardware isn't going to compare to what you're going to see right now, like on a PlayStation demo, right? And it's just going to look bad in comparison. So that's why they're not doing it. It's a marketing ploy to trick you into buying one, which I understand. And I think maybe they need to do it at this point in time just to get the funding to make it better.
Yep.
So I know what they're doing. I get it.
Yeah. I mean, I think we're getting closer to the point where we will hopefully see a spike in users, just because now we've got the Quest 2. And the original Quest that you, like you said, you don't have to have a machine, so that eliminates that barrier right there. You can take it with you on the go. It's not quite as cumbersome, you know. So I think things like that will definitely attribute to more people investing. I think we've talked about it before, but I feel like the industry shot itself in the foot a little bit, you know, towards the early days of VR when they started doing mobile VR. with things like Google Cardboard and Lenovo and stuff putting out these like really cheap plastic headsets that you stick your phone in.
Yeah.
And it just kind of turned everyone away from wanting to do that again because they all felt nauseous and, you know, yeah. headaches after looking at their phone that close, which is not meant for that. So anyways, I think they've got some ground.
The refresh rate on their phone isn't fast enough to make it realistic. That's why people are getting dizzy. Once you get up to 90 hertz, you know, you can't tell. It's and you're good.
Yeah, yeah. So definitely interesting. I guess we'll have to wait and see what happens. I mean, that statement alone makes me think we're not getting another a new PlayStation VR.
Oh, they're not. Yeah, they announced it.
Oh, really? They made that public?
Yeah, when the next generation comes out, it's not going to have PlayStation VR support. Up front.
Oh, I thought I read today that it is going to have support for PSVR. I thought that's what I read as part of this article. I might have to double check, but
well, no, I might be wrong. I remember reading it about it like a week ago, so maybe it's changed. I know
things
that
change
a couple games, like No Man's Sky for one, isn't going to be on PlayStation VR. It's going to be on the PlayStation, but there won't be like PlayStation VR support. So maybe maybe that's what it was, and there will actually be PSVR, but I don't think it's going to release when the next gen console comes out. I think it's going to be delayed.
Okay. Yeah, that would make sense.
Yeah. So I guess pretty cool. I think, you know, just kind of sticking in topic with that, you know, there's a company called Interhaptics. And, you know, we were just kind of talking about like, what is it going to take to, you know, create more immersion in the world to get more people playing it. And so Interhaptics has, you know, just released two programs, Haptic Composer and Interaction Builder. You know, they went through 7 months of beta testing and have, you know, now released these mixed reality development platforms, this development suite for deploying haptics across platforms. You know, cross platforms being head mounted displays and even mobile devices. So, by the way, when I say haptics, I'm talking about like vibrating controllers, right? Or, you know, a vibrating chess piece or foot pads or, you know, whatever it may be, hands, gloves, I guess. So, you know, just coming straight from their website, what's Haptic Composer? This is what they had to say. Haptic Composer is a graphical tool that allows you to create haptics in minutes for hours worth of work. The application will enable you to design high quality haptics feedback, which increases user experience within digital creations. Its counterpart, Interaction Builder, is a low code 3D engines plugin to develop realistic hand interactions in within three clicks. That's pretty crazy. The application increases the value of the creation while significantly decreasing the time of development. Best used for hand tracking and UX, which is basically user interface, essentially. Yeah. So they've claimed that their suite facilitates 90% faster development time compared to competitors. And real quick before I ask your input on all this, a couple like use cases that we're talking about here is like UI notifications on your phone or in your headset, immersion for emotional connection. I kind of want to know a little bit more about that. Contextual or spatial awareness. Spatial awareness being like if you ran into a wall, it would, you know, your head would vibrate or, you know, whatever kind of haptics you have on would vibrate. And then smart clothing or wearables. I think this is really where the opportunity comes in is, you know, gloves, shoes, you know, maybe even some, you know, pants or a shirt or some like, you know, chest piece, whatever it may be.
Yeah.
And finally, remote presence applications. That's another one. I'm not really too keen on what they're trying to say there. You know, I think
maybe like
it's probably
virtual teleconferencing or something.
Yeah. Yeah. Virtual teleconferencing or, you know, who knows? I'm going two sides of the spectrum here. We're talking meditation and then the other side of the spectrum where I can let you think that one up on your own. but yeah,
emotional connection.
Emotional connection. Anyway,
That's like a Snoop Dogg, like the remix of Sexual Seduction. Emotional connections.
That's what plays when you're actually programming. Yeah.
That's hilarious.
Yeah, man. So I think 90% increase, right? So we're just talking about like, how can we get us to the next level? Well, this is a step in the right direction where you're saving people 90% of their time. So you're going to get like a high quantity of, you know, programs now that have, you know, more functionality, more immersive functionality. So yeah. What are your thoughts, man? This is the step in the right direction, I think.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, just like we were talking about with the PlayStation thing, I think this is the kind of stuff that gets us closer inch by inch. I think anytime, I mean, we've already been at this point where they've turned things over to developers to give them the opportunities to, you know, I, like I said, anytime that a company hands something over for a third party development support or makes something open source or whatever, it just like warp speeds the capabilities of whatever it is. Like, for instance, even Apple, you know, I'm in like a beta group or whatever for Apple, so I get this early software a little bit faster than most people, whether it's not fully fleshed out or whatever, you know. So when I had the latest beta for the phone before third parties developers were able to work with some of the new features, it's pretty limited in what it can do because it's just Apple's integrations with it that are there. So, but then when the software became public and third party developers were able to release their, you know, integrations, it just supercharged what you're able to do with the software. So same goes here, like opening this has been opened up for developers previously, but saving them the time and making it easier for them to develop. This means that smaller teams, smaller companies can get their hands dirty with this kind of stuff. Whereas before they might have to rely on outsourcing development work to, you know, get some of this stuff done and create interesting interfaces. But I love what you're talking about with like smart clothing. I could definitely see like wearing a long sleeve shirt that has different haptic sensors within it, you know, different small, super small little vibration motors or something. So if you get hit with a sword in a VR experience or something, your shoulder, your arm, wherever relative to where you got hit is like vibrating, just to increase that level of immersion. And I'm not really sure how you would assign haptics to UI notifications, but obviously, you know, I could imagine something where you're wearing a glove, and if you're touching menu items or something in the UI, you know, the vibration motor on the tip of your finger buzzes as you touch, or, you know, something like that. I think anything like that increases that a level of immersion and makes you want to stay in there longer.
Yeah. I think that was a perfect example of how we could, you know, those were two very good examples of, you know, how this could be, advancing VR as we know it, for the future. So, yeah, very, very cool.
Exciting,
man. Very
stuff.
Cool. Yeah, if anybody's, you know, if you're listening and you're a developer or you know a developer, you know, let them know about InterHaptics. Go check them out. You can go to their website and get a demo. I don't have their website in front of me. I'm pretty sure it's just interhaptics.com. But you can go check them out, get demos of their suite, and find a solution for you if you're looking into something like that. So, you know, help the VR community grow, and, you know, this might be a good way to do it.
Yep, definitely. All right, man, I think it's time to get to our last section, talk about some video games.
Let's do it, man. I'm ready to talk about the gaming grind. Every day,
oh,
the
yes.
Gaming grind.
Every day we grinding. Cool. So I got an interesting story here. This is actually, I meant to talk about this last week. We just ran out of time. It's about politicians. I don't like to talk politics on this show. It's not really our shtick. We try to stay away from that. This is a different angle, though. So regardless of your leanings, your political leanings, this is an interesting story. So Alexandria, I don't know how to pronounce this. Ocasio-Cortez?
I think that's it, yeah.
More commonly known as AOC. She's a 31-year-old Democratic representative. So very young for a politician. She streamed a new game called Among Us, which, to be honest with you guys, I've seen all this hype around this game called Among Us. I don't really know what it's about. Have you ever heard of this game?
Yeah, it's the thing right now.
Yeah, it's the hot thing, right? It's the new hotness. Can you give us a break? Because I have no idea what this game's about. Do you have like a high level?
Yeah, yeah, like very high level. I think you could almost kind of liken it to like a board game in which there's a group of party members, and it basically consists of tests. You're testing one another to see who is the
informant,
who is like the informant or like the bad guy, basically, and you're trying to catch the bad guy while not getting eliminated or eliminating the wrong people. You know, I think I probably butchered it, but I think that's what it is.
So it sounds very similar to that game we played. What was it, like Party Pack or something? What was that, Jack in the Box?
It was Jack in the Box, and it was like the Catch the Alien one. I can't remember what it was called, but but like just like way more fun than that.
Simply put, just more fun.
Yeah.
So okay, cool. Now that I know what that's about. Yeah, so anyways, she's a very young politician. She streamed Among Us on Twitch. And what's interesting about this is that she had one of the most popular streams ever on Twitch in history, peaking at 435,000 simultaneous viewers. I don't know if she has any sort of history as a streamer. It's definitely possible, and you know, I'd have no idea. But what I thought was interesting about this is just, you know, regardless of the fact of how she got that many viewers, obviously she's got some clout being a Democratic representative. She's been in the news. She's in constant talk. I mean, people talk about her all the time one reason or another. But what I wanted to talk about with you is just, I think it's interesting that politicians now, or at least her, have this opportunity to use gaming as sort of an outlet to get their, you know, regardless if that's what she did or not. I didn't watch the stream. I don't know if she's talking about her, you know, political ideology or not while she was doing it, but 435,000 people watching you simultaneously, not including the people who watched it later, is a large population of individuals to have your message broadcast to. So I'm curious, like, I don't know, is this a good thing? Is it a bad thing? Is it a weird thing? Like, to me, honestly, I feel like gaming is almost like a safe neutral zone. You know what I mean? Like, so far, well, sorry, let me make this clear. In terms of politicians, in terms of politics, like, gaming is absolutely not a safe space when it comes to people being jerks, right? That happens all the time. But when it comes to politics, like, you don't really see a lot of that. You don't hear a lot of talk about politics. People don't talk about that when they're playing games. There's definitely, I've seen before, lots of like in-game ad placements, you know, so that's sort of intruded in the space already. But this was kind of a new one for me. Just that thought kind of came in my head. I wanted to see what your take on that was.
I could understand Twitch as a platform for, you know, kind of touting your political ideals. You know, I think that is a thing that has happened, or, you know, I know the BLM movement was a big thing on, still probably is still a big thing. I'm not really following Twitch too much right now, but, earlier this year, I know that the BLM movement was pretty big on Twitch. There was a lot going on there. So I can understand, you know, utilizing Twitch to get your message out there. I don't, you know, I think that the only like political things that are in video games are probably just like parodies of, you know, political satire, you know, stuff like that. But never anything like real, because I don't think people would... I think they would hit the power button at that point, right?
Yeah.
If you started, you know, trying to convince me while I'm playing Fallout that you want me to vote, you know, however you want me to vote, you know, I'd be like, man, no thanks. You know, but on Twitch, you know, maybe that's a little bit different. And she's certainly very popular in the younger generations and whatnot. And a lot of the younger generations are, you know, video gamers, right? Everybody that's grown up, you know, in the past, you know, 30 years or whatnot, you know, where gaming is a part of life, you know, at this point, basically. And, you know, Twitch streaming is growing, and it's getting pretty darn big. You know, the fact that she had almost 500,000 viewers at one point, kind of just proof in the pudding there. It's, you know, I'm sure that's actually, you know, beating a lot of news channels and a lot of, you know, regular television programming channels at this point. So, Yeah. You're probably jealous of her.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think this last Khabib versus Gaethje fight had 600 and some thousand purchases on pay-per-view, which is like one of the highest ever, I think.
Yeah.
So we're talking about a giant headline fight. And this is a silly game on Twitch, right? So, well, yeah, well, I mean,
actually, hold on. Also, not to mention, she probably made a ton of money. You know,
yeah,
I don't know if they gave her partnership right away, or how that works, but if they gave her partnership right away, then she made bank, man. She probably made, you know, tens of thousands of dollars, to, you know, contribute to her campaign, which I think is great. And I had one more point, but I forgot it. So,
yeah, I mean, I guess optimist take on this is it's at least a nice organic sort of way to reach viewers as opposed to ad placements. Like, I get tired of ad placements constantly. You know what's hilarious is my 4-year-old Kai, you know, there's a politician running for office locally here, I guess she's for Virginia, Elaine Loria, right? I don't follow politics that much. Anyways, she's running for whatever, and he gets tired of hearing her name on the TV. So, like, whenever her commercial comes on, he's like, Elaine Loria again. He, like, plugs his ears and, like, walks away. I'm just like, I feel you, bro. I feel you. So, yeah. You know, so at least it's kind of an organic way. You know, if she was going about it, you know, I guess in a passive sort of way. And again, I'm not saying she did it for this reason or another reason, but she had a giant audience. So,
yeah.
Well, good for her, I guess.
Well, this is the point that I forgot, is also akin to podcasting. It's kind of like long form. Well, I wouldn't say long form news, but it's a long form way for her to get her point across. Well, you know, when you watch a debate, you get 10 seconds to respond. You're not going to, nobody's going to know. You can use a couple choice words and nobody's going to really know what you're talking about. So she's got a long form way where she can have 500,000 viewers listen to her ideals, line up with her, get closer to her, be more, you know, loyal to her, vote for her, right?
Yeah.
I think it's incredibly
smart.
Smart, you know, for her to do it that way. Very cool.
Yeah, definitely. So,
not a lot of time left. But let's end with a little Halloween theme, right? This is Halloween weekend. Tomorrow is Halloween, like literally 2 hours from when we're recording this. So, you know, this should be interesting. What's your favorite horror game of all time? I'm gonna just throw a couple out there, right? And then let me know if you line up with any of these, okay?
Okay.
I remember the first scary game as a child, and I couldn't sleep. I had nightmares. Resident Evil 1 and 2 on the original PlayStation, it scared the crap out of me. I couldn't even play it. I had to wait like a year before I went back and actually played it through because it scared me so much. I played it for like 10 minutes, and I was so scared that I basically put it down, and then I didn't play it for a while.
Yeah. Which one was it? So let me just say this out front so people know. I'm a teenage girl when it comes to horror anything. I don't watch scary movies. My wife and I, fortunately, are on the same page. We do not watch scary movies. We don't watch scary anything because we're total sissies when it comes to that stuff. And I'm man enough to tell you right now that I don't like scary stuff.
Well, I'm right there with you.
With that said, I'm having a hard time remembering Silent Hill. Okay, Silent Hill. That was a video game, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They made it into a movie also.
Okay, that's what I thought. So that for some reason I was thinking that was Resident Evil, but it wasn't. I remember playing a Resident Evil game like way back in the day. I don't remember which one it was, but you're like walking down a hallway, and this probably applies to like all of them. And like it's a quiet, dark hallway, boarded up windows, and then just like out of nowhere, hands bust through the windows, and like they're trying to grab at your character, and you have to take off running, and I'm like, yep, I'm done. I don't want this game anymore. I don't want to play this.
Yeah. So you were probably playing Resident Evil 1, and you know, that's what it was, man. Is you know, it's got jump that little scares. Jumpy scare factor where they play some music that scares you even more, and then this weird looking zombie just comes lurching towards you, and
yeah,
you know, and eventually it'll get you on the ground and it's eating your brains. And yeah, man. Oh man. Was yeah. Yeah. But I mean, I'm right there with you, dude. I don't watch scary movies anymore. I don't need that in my life. And I don't play scary games anymore. I also don't need that in my life, but
no,
when I was growing up, I, you know, I tried a little bit of everything. So, you know, a couple games that are real close to heart, and, you know, some folks might disagree with me on this one, but I grew up playing Diablo, you know, all the time. So as a young child, I was playing Diablo, and for me, that was scary enough because you had all these demons running around chasing you, skeletons, imps, and demons. And, I mean, honestly, it gave me certainly a adrenaline boost to have these things running at me. And,
right,
you know, you'd creep around a corner and then you got a whole horde of zombies running at you. I mean, it was a little scary and, you know, certainly fits the genre, of horror, but not quite like Resident Evil 1 or 2. And then
not jump scary as much.
Yeah. Not so much jump scary, but certainly very, I don't know, maybe cryptic and, you know, I don't know, satanic, I guess, certainly satanic. Yep. But, and then finally Doom, kind of in the same thing. It's a first person shooter. Not as much jump scary, but still very creepy and weird. And there were some jumpy moments throughout the whole Doom franchise. You know, so that was another one, man. Just some weird, weird stuff. So how about you?
Yeah, like I said, I didn't play a ton of horror games. One that stood out in my mind when you asked this question was Manhunt. I don't know if you remember these Manhunt games. I guess less demonic, less jump scary, but just like psycho sort of thriller stuff. Like I remember one thing where you like, I guess you're a good guy. I don't remember honestly the plot of it, but I think you were a good guy trying to escape like the capture of, you know, whatever. You're like, you're trying to escape something. At least the part of the game I remember was you're trying to escape and you pick up these random items you find around. And one of the things you could pick up was like a plastic bag, and you could sneak up on people and just like suffocate them with this plastic bag. And I'm just like, this is terrifying for a 13-year-old or something. This is traumatic.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I'm just like, oh, this is such a eerie game. But and then on top of that, zombies, Call of Duty zombies. So again, not really, kind of in the same sort of category as Doom, you know, in the sense of first person shooter, not really jump scary, but still sort of like, I don't really want to play it in a dark room by myself because it just creeps me out. But
yeah,
you know, I have just kind of strayed away from those games. The one, like I mentioned earlier, Silent Hill, I just remember being like out in a town or something by yourself, and like you're having these like flashbacks of something happening, and like, you know, when the clock tower starts to make a noise, and the sky turns a different color, and these music, creepy music starts, and then the town turns into like this snowy sort of ash covered landscape, and you have to like run away from it. Like, it's just like, I don't want to play this game right now.
Yeah.
So yeah.
So well, that's, I stay, yeah, man, that stuff. I feel it, dude. I played a ton of Call of Duty zombies, man. And I mean, yeah, when you're like running down a hallway and you don't think any zombies, and then one of them just comes lurching out and attacks you, like I'd be jumpy on that one too. So
yeah,
they all kind of fit in like the Halloween theme, maybe not like your traditional, like super scary horror game, but you know, yeah, pretty cool. But yeah, man.
I'm interested, you guys out there listening, let us know what your favorite horror games are. I think that's a great question. We should even put it out on Instagram, see if we can get any response on that.
Oh, perfect. Yeah, let's do it.
I know a couple of podcasters, especially the guys from the Midwest Meltdown, they probably have some recommendations for scary games. But
well, speaking of other podcasts, why don't we go ahead and give a couple shout outs?
Yeah, definitely, let's do it.
All right. Well, you know, I mean, just to start us off, I think, you know, just going off of what you just said, Midwest Meltdown, you know, shout out to those guys. You know, I've listened to plenty of their episodes and you know, they've been shouting us out on Twitter a bunch, which I certainly appreciate.
Awesome.
But, you know, yeah, what were you going to, you were going to say something about them. Did I cut you off?
No.
Okay, yeah. I mean, yeah. Shout out to those guys. Go check them out. Go check out their Twitter. I don't have their handle in front of me, but it's the Midwest Meltdown. So go check them out on Twitter. You'll find their stuff there. These guys are cool. Midwestern guys playing video games. Sit back, chilling, having a good time, talking about the games that they play, talking about the things that they're doing. Nice, easygoing podcast that I certainly recommend. We've shouted them out before and certainly don't regret it.
Yeah, definitely. And it is at Midwest Meltdown on Twitter.
Perfect.
And check them out on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. And I guess we should shout out the Beers and Beards podcast one last time. We definitely recommend you guys go check out that episode we recorded earlier this week to get to know them a little bit better. But then definitely go and drop them a follow and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and check out their Facebook page. With the, I think you can find it just by searching Beers and Beards podcast. They're doing bourbon notes, which is a funny little thing they're doing because David does not know how yet to describe the flavor profiles of bourbons, which I fall in that same category. So he described it as bourbon. This bourbon gives me a lot of bourbon notes. So check them out for sure.
They also talk about a little bit of UFC action, you know, during their during their time, and David actually has a website, MMAMcKinney.com, so make sure to go check them out as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Cool, man. Well, I think that about does it for the week. That was a great episode. I hope you guys enjoyed that. Before we wrap it up here, guys, I just want to remind you all to please like and subscribe here on YouTube, and also subscribe in your favorite podcast player. You can find us in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Pocket Cast, really wherever you find your podcasts. We are most likely there. And if we're not, please send us a message. We want to be there. And, again, like we said at the beginning, if you really want to help us grow the show, please share this episode and our show with a friend. That goes the furthest with us, and we really appreciate everyone's support.
Thank you guys so much. Until next time, have a good one.
See ya.